Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. I'm a sexual medicine gynecologist and menopause expert in downtown Chicago. And I'm here today for a very amazing conversation, long time in the making. It's a conversation that's really a layered conversation. It is a women's health, well, women's healthcare is layered, so we have to be really in depth about how we're addressing this. But today we're going to talk about hysterectomies, a surgery for so many that's really life-saving and liberating, but can also be very devastating. But I also want to talk to my friend here, Dr. Camila Phillips, about all the things that she's been doing and, you know, what brought her to this position in her life. I talk about the dynamics of power, gender, and race, body consent, and all the things. My guest today is Dr. Camila Phillips. She is an OBGYN, an advocate, menopause educator, board-certified OBGYN, an author now of The Empowered Hysterectomy, a book that doesn't just explain hysterectomies as a surgery, but forces us to reckon with what it is, why it is, and how it is, and to reimagine the future of women getting hysterectomies. So, Camila Phillips, welcome to my show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that intro. I'm like, oh, I did that? Okay, that's
yes,
me.
Yes, you did. Oh, I was so excited that you put this out there. And I've been trying to get her on for months, but she and I have crazy schedules. So last time we saw each other at Ishwish, and we were like, okay, we're going to make this happen. That's how Camila and I first met, I think, either at Ishwish or Menopause Society. I don't know. Or was it online? I don't remember.
I think I was fangirling online, and then I met you in person. You know, I met you in person. I think we thought we knew each other, but we hadn't actually connected. Yes, I think that's what it was.
That's the joy of social media. You know, I think there's so many downsides to it, but the upsides are the relationships we form.
The relationships, 100%.
And so that's one of the greatest things. But I want to talk to you, like my name on this show is Gyno Girl. So I love comics and I love superheroes. And I love a good, origin story. So tell us your origin story about how you got to going to women's health, how you advocate so fiercely for all women and women, especially like bring us to light here.
Yeah. So I'll tell you two quick stories of how I got here. The first is that I was raised by my grandparents and my aunts.
You talk about them in your book, by the way. I love that you bring that in and weave that in because that's such a, I think, an essential part of understanding so much of like storytelling and history.
But, you know, so many of us, I think we forget or don't acknowledge that so many of us were raised in multi-generational households and how that impacts your life, how like your grandmother's experience or your grandfather being ignored or your aunties on the bathroom floor, you know, ultimately unable to take care of you and carry the family, how much that impacts you growing up. So their care of me was always impacted when they were having some type of hormonal menstrual issue. And I never really realized that until I got older and how important that was. And, you know, I think I honestly sealed the deal. I was talking to my mom about this the other day. When I was probably like ninth grade, she entered me in this like ridiculous beauty pageant. And it was before it was like scholarship and all that stuff. It was, and I was the only Black girl in the pageant. And I was like, doggone it. What did I get myself into? So we were in the interview portion and on my resume, because low-key, I've been doing, I was 15 working at Planned Parenthood, right? So on my little, you know, my ninth grade like application, it had that I was a student advocate at Planned Parenthood. And one of the judges asked me about that, like, what do you do at Planned Parenthood? And I said, well, I go to a high school where there are actually miniature lockers underneath some lockers because girls in my school bring their children to school in order for them to stay in high school. So I, through Planned Parenthood, spent a lot of time talking about birth control, ways to prevent pregnancy, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, but I was already doing the work, right? And he's like, I just don't understand that. Abstinence is the way. And I looked at him and I was like,
because that's where I grew up.
Oh my God. This is San Diego. This was California.
Oh Lord. I was like, that was my story in Gastonia, North Carolina. But you actually grew up in the West Coast. So.
yeah, I thought, you know, like progressive, well, yeah. you know, quote unquote progressive West Coast. And he's like, isn't abstinence the way? And I just sat there and I was like, no, there are actually other options. And I went into like why it's important to talk about all the options and have an in-depth, a multi-layered conversation about sex and intimacy with young people. Because clearly my experience is girls were having babies in high school. And so I lost the competition.
Well, I wonder, like, they're like, oh, she's saying pre-sex is okay for teens.
Exactly. So I got like a zero on the interview portion. And at that point, I was like, you know, middle finger to the sky. Yeah. And I had this one talent scheduled. And instead, I sang the Black National Anthem because I was like, if I'm going to be my true self, I'm just going to do it. But I think that was the like, okay, women's health, because this is not going to work.
Exactly. I love it. I love that story, actually. And so then, you know, obviously you're a board certified OBGYN. And later at the end for fun, we're going to talk about your real world experience.
I know.
I need some dish on that.
Oh my gosh. Lord. Okay. Lord.
Anyway, but so then like obviously you've been practicing for a while and then you decided that I need to become an author too. Because you have your own practice. I know you and I were about to talk about how we used to be in academics and corporate sort of medicine more so. Yeah. We both have practices. Yeah. So you're still doing obstetrics, which hopefully will change at some point.
Hopefully will change soon. Yeah.
But you decided to write this book, The Empowered Hysterectomy, which I love. Tell me about why you decided to write that, because it was so needed, of course. But
yeah, you know, it was so amazing. Being in private practice, I think, is a quite different experience than some of the other models. And when I tell you I'm in New York City, I would have women, particularly women of color, coming in and I would hear the same story over and over and over. And at one point, I was having this rash of women who were coming in, reproductive age, talking about how the provider they had seen previously was offering them hysterectomy for whatever their ailment was. And I was like, but what about over here, this other procedure? What about this pill? Or what about, you know? And one day, I kid you not, I had a 21-year-old come in. And she had been advised, because she had fibroids, that she probably was never going to get pregnant and she should just have a hysterectomy.
What?
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Oh my God.
How, one, wrong that is. Two, insensitive. And three, just like the shock and awe for her that when she was in my office, I cried because I was like, what are we, what is going on?
What are we doing? Exactly.
What are we doing? And so I wrote the book because I found, like, in particular, women of color, and we know the statistics are there, right? Women of color are overwhelmingly shuttled to hysterectomy than their white counterparts, who are offered the rainbow of options. And I realized I couldn't take care of everyone, but I could give them the information that they needed so that when they walked into the doctor's office, they literally felt empowered and they were meeting the physician with information, options, and access to, you know, me, even if it was in the form of a book. And the response has been really, truly amazing, because it's not just about hysterectomy, right? There are all these conditions that lead up to hysterectomy that still also have a ton of options. And I find it so shocking that in 2025, 26, we're still not giving women options.
I know. And that's why I say this book really isn't sort of like, it's not anti-hysterectomy. It's really pro-information. Really, it's like, what are the options and what happens if you decide to go there? Which I think is, you know, and it's astounding to hear, but I see it all the time. You know, people are like, well, I'm just here for a second opinion. Do you think I need a hysterectomy? And I was like, well, have you tried this? Have you tried that? Because You know, right. It's major surgery. We can talk about all this, but, you know, it doesn't go without its risks and benefits. So,
exactly. And the thing is, though, is when someone is properly counseled, anything from, hey, you actually have the right to do nothing, yeah, to you have the right to, like, take out this body part. When they make the decision, say, for example, and I tried really carefully not to be anti-hysterectomy because it absolutely has a role. But when you give them that range of choice and informed consent and, like, all the options and why they may or may not work, all the little things you distill down, so many people are actually really happy that they made the decision to have their hysterectomy. It's life-changing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I love how you kind of weave in some of your stories about yourself. And I want to talk, before we talk about some of the history and the medicalization and the history of hysterectomies, I want to talk about your story about when you first got your period, because menstrual shaming is so huge in many cultures. I know in South Asian, mm-hmm, culture, within Islamic religion, within certain religions, you can't even go to, you know, temples or mosques, you know, you can't participate in things when you're menstruating. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much shame, mm-hmm, around it. But I loved how you told the story of your menarche and how you got a period party, which is, like, so much more common now. And I'm waiting for my 13-year-old to to empower this, but she's a little bit away. But tell us a little bit about, you know, I love that story.
So, he was my favorite uncle. My uncle Greg was in the Navy, and every year he would take me out on the boat, carrier. It was huge, because they would have, like, family day. And I went to the bathroom, you know, like these cold military latrines, and I pulled down my underwear to pee. And it was just like this stain of red. I kind of knew, but didn't know, but was in disbelief of, like, what was happening. And I was like, oh, no, I know what this is. And I put my pants back on, and then I went to tell Uncle Greg, like, Uncle Greg, I started my period. And not that he was period shamed, right? But he was like this 40-year-old, like, Midwest man who had zero information or any assistance at all. And he rounded up some of the wives who were also on the carrier. And these, again, just cultural, right? These were like automatic aunties who stepped in and, you know, taught me how to basically make a pad with toilet paper. How many times have I done that, right? Yeah. How many times has that come into, I've had an emergency and had to do that. Oh. So, and when I got home, everyone was like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, because my aunts had such a negative history in relationship with their uterus. And I was, like, so bummed, because all my little Sweet 16 books told me it was supposed to be, like, this coming of age thing. And they could see just, like, how annoyed I was with their disappointment that my mom threw me a period party. And I've done the same with my daughter, even though she was mortified. But it's this, you know, acknowledgement and celebration that our bodies are changing, that puberty is a thing, and that it's okay to talk about blood, and it's okay to have, you know, people in the household experiencing these things. So, he's still, to this date, my favorite uncle.
I think that's great. And I feel like it's more common now. Like, you know, I think even probably in the last 10 or 15 years, I've heard about it more, but probably for your mom, that was pretty progressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because I actually come from a Southern Baptist household.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Oh, child, yes. My family is from Virginia, Arkansas. We lived in a city or town in Arkansas that didn't, until recently, probably get on the map. Mm-hmm. My grandfather is a preacher. Mm-hmm. My grandmother worked as a cafeteria worker. So we were very solidly, like, working class Christian people. And so, no, you didn't talk about those things.
Not at all.
You didn't talk about those things. And I love to, like, bug my mom every now and then and remind her that she's still actually never had the talk with me. Like, she's never, You know, it's, I got a period party, never had a conversation about sex.
Waiting every month. Who knows why? Like, you'll figure it out.
Exactly. She'll figure it out. She's smart, right? Yeah. So, no, I came from the same background where, like, we didn't talk about these things.
Especially, like, in this, like, I grew up in the South, but I also, like, my parents were immigrants. So, of course, there was no discussion. Zero. Like, it was really double whammy almost. But no, I love that story of the celebration because there is so much stigma attached to menstruation for so many.
Yeah.
And I think it's across the board. It's just not, like, you know,
it's across the board.
You know, you hear about, you know, what's that old joke? You never trust something that bleeds for 7 days and doesn't die or something.
And doesn't die? I'm like, it's not my fault. I'm magical. Yeah, exactly. And you're like, right?
Exactly. I make life. You don't. Like,
you don't. That's, you know, don't put that on me. Yeah, I'm magical. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to talk about this, the chapter in your book where you talk about medicalization and the control of women's bodies. That was such a powerful chapter or group, you know, part in your book where we really talk about the, you know, the history of hysterectomies. I liked how you brought in, you know, your relationship with, was it your maternal grandfather? I think.
Because
like even learning about, you know, the history of the United States with slavery and all the things that you learned about through like a lot of what he taught you, but even, I mean, you know, people try to not talk about this issue, to not talk about the history of OBGYN in this country and the history of so much of what we've done has been on the backs of slave women in this country. And I think it's very important to bring this up and for people to recognize, you know, what hysterectomies were historically, you know, how we learned about complications from these things and acknowledge the real, true, like, heroes involved. And so can you talk us through your chapter on that briefly?
Yeah, of course, of course. So my grandfather was, in my eyes, a brilliant man. And he was an expert, like PhD, in African-American history and American history. And he had this little room that was a library. And I would go in there and we would just go through books and he would teach me lessons. And it's weird because I didn't remember the story until I was in residency, OBGYN residency. And I was like, this sounds so familiar. But my grandfather actually was the beginning of me understanding the intersection of race and history and gender and medicine. He was very progressive in that time in that, like, you can't talk about one thing without talking about the other because they're just so intertwined. But he would tell me stories of how enslaved women were obviously forced, because there's no room for consent there, were forced to have their bodies experimented on for the sake of advancing not only gynecology, but literally every field in a early medical practice. And women's issues are typically left to women, and we know that historically, but as slavery was ending in the United States, there needed to be another source for bodies, for souls in the United States. And that caused slave owners to have a real investment in the reproduction of Black women. So as a result, midwives, like granny midwives or midwives, were really demonized and removed from women's health, enter sort of unlearned white men into this economy who were paid by enslaved people to keep our wombs healthy, to allow us to reproduce and reproduce at a very fast rate. And if you can imagine, an enslaved woman is overworked, undernourished, and had terrible pregnancies, like, you know, trauma, terrible pregnancies. One of those complications being a fistula, which is where, like, the bladder connects to the uterus, connects to the rectum. You can imagine the pain, the smell, the embarrassment, shame that comes with that. And so these newfounded doctors were charged with, like, hey, we got to fix this because I need her to reproduce every year. And so when we look at that and how money and capitalism was the primary focus as opposed to history, a few names in particular stand out. Dr. Sims, mm-hmm. and three slaves, although there mm-hmm. were many, many more. The history books don't afford them names, but Arnacha, Betsy, and Lucy, their history of being operated on over 30 times without anesthesia. And historians will say, well, anesthesia wasn't available. Yes, it was at the time. Yeah, the detailing of really the beginning of gynecology on the backs of these three enslaved women is something that I didn't remember until I was back in residency. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my gosh, here I am, the descendants of slaves, now kind of participating in this process. And so in my operating room, whenever I pull out the instrument, which formerly for me is called Sims, I renamed it Lucy, and I share the story of how we don't think about it, but every single thing we have done in this country is on the backs of enslaved mm-hmm. people. And so I tell, you know, my resident or whoever I'm working with, even the scrub tech is like, I've never heard that story. And I've been scrubbing my whole life. I tell everyone the story because it's important that we understand that everything we have done in gynecology, how we deal with obstructive labor, how we deal with fistulas, how we do C-sections, how we do hysterectomies are all born on women of color. And even in the South, I would ask them, have you ever heard of the Mississippi appendectomy, which to me was like, oh yeah, learned that when I was seven. Not, again, understanding the intersection of all of these really integral pieces of life. You know, the residents are like, what are you, an appendectomy? Yeah. And really, hysterectomies, literally women in the South would go in for a procedure that they thought was like, an appendectomy, hence the name, or other fibroid surgery. And that is where the white medical students, primarily men, because again, those were the doctors, white men at that time, would practice performing hysterectomies on women without their knowledge and consent. And it was only when they realized, wait, I can't have kids, I'm infertile, did they learn that their uterus had been removed. And so in that backdrop, this book was so important to me because the legacy of that remains. Yeah. There's no reason there's 600,000 hysterectomies every year, a majority in the South on Black women, that we shouldn't be talking about this history.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously history is really dictated by the people who are telling it, right? Because, I mean, I have to tell you that, you know, growing up in the South, you know, what we learned about the Civil War was states' rights. Literally, I had to read Malcolm X's autobiography before I realized, like, you know, we didn't land on planes, but, you know, that was the whole thing. I was like, damn, this was about slavery. I mean, it was a real epiphany moment because they brainwash you. And my dad was like, yeah, you know, that wasn't about states' rights, right? Like, he would tell me, and I was like, no, Dad, but that's what they keep saying. And, you know, like, I used to watch the Dukes of Hazzard, and the Confederate flag was like,
oh, yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh. And then I realized,
no, I don't remember my age range exactly because I know it was in like the late 80s, but I would not get in the car through opening the door. I would go through the window because I agreed. That's how much Dukes of Hazzard and the Confederate flag was just like, that's the flag. And we don't realize how brainwashed, ingrained we are into this narrative that we, as immigrants, as people of color, have not uplifted this
country.
Absolutely,
because you won't find that in places like, you know, Germany. They're not putting up, you know, statues of Hitler. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, this is like, they reckon with their history. And I feel like we keep trying to, and there are people keep trying to tell us not to do it. Like, but this is something that has to be, we would not be in the positions we were had it not been for that situation, honestly, you know?
And I don't think that we would be where we are currently if we just decide to reckon with it. Yeah. Like, it's everywhere. We have to reckon with it. It's in the woman of color who comes into an exam room and a white man walks in and she's just like a little nervous and can't articulate what her needs are or doesn't tell the full truth about a situation because these things from 300-400 years ago have permeated that doctor-patient relationship. And who does that? It doesn't help her because she leaves with questions unanswered, tests unfulfilled, with the same issues. And it doesn't help the physician because 99.9% of us, right, want to do the right thing.
Yes.
We want to do the right thing, but if you don't realize like where your patient is coming from, what her trauma may be, why she may not open up to you, then we've both just like wasted 20 minutes of our lives.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you see it daily. I see it daily. It's still trending, you know, like, you know, people are still posting about how, you know, women of color, Black women are being mistreated in deliveries. The maternal mortality rate is still ridiculously high. And this is medical racism. Yeah. I mean, I don't deliver babies anymore. And my last patient I was treating a Black patient for her sexual dysfunction. And she finally was able to have like penetrative sex for the first time. And she finally got pregnant with her spouse and started crying when I did her pregnancy test and I did her first trimester scan. And then she started crying and I was like, what's the matter? I thought it was tears of joy. And she goes, you're not going to be my OB. And I said, yeah. And she goes, I'm worried that I'm going to die because you're the only person that's listened to me, you know? And I was like, you know, it was so hard.
No, I know.
It was really hard. I left the room crying. And I was like, no, listen, if you feel unheard, here's my number. Like, text me. I'll try to do what I can. I don't want you to feel that you have no support.
Yeah.
Like, but she literally was, because I had been working with her for a couple of years at that point to try to get her pain for sex. And
I hear that all the time. Like, patients who... I'm like, okay, so what do you want to get out of this delivery? And they're like, I just want to live. And I'm like, okay, can we elevate the expectations? I'm like, can we do a little bit better? But I completely understand where they're coming from. And there are some patients who like, at some point in the pregnancy, many, I'm like, you're on a TikTok ban. You're on an Instagram ban because the fear starts to permeate us. And again, it's not an accident. The medical system is doing what it was designed to do. And that is to not take care of women, not take care of people of color, not take care of immigrants. It is designed for white men. And until we recognize and like say it, so that we can start working through the hard truths and center care around South Asian women. Can you imagine?
Yeah. No, it's
center care around Mexican immigrants. Center care around Central and South American immigrants, because those are different people.
Absolutely. Yeah, or the indigenous different tribes, you know, like...
Exactly. You know, center care around Black women who we know, I mean, even in the... What do I live in? Borough, right up the street, you know, has like an 11 to 12 times increased risk of dying. Whereas you come to Manhattan and it's still dangerous, labor and pregnancy, but it's 3 to 4. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And all of those exponentially more than our white counterparts. So it's doing what it's designed to do, but we have to be willing to like take off the Band-Aid and... talk about it and center someone else other than white men and whiteness. Yeah.
And, you know, I hear people tell, because when I give talks about bias, they're like, no, but that's not like, that's because of this or that or socioeconomic. I'm like, no, it's people like Serena Williams. It's people like pediatrician. It is not. It is just being of color.
Yeah.
Okay. It's nothing to do with where, you know, where they live, where they, you know, their education level. There was that pediatrician last year that died in Indiana. You know, who was a labor, you know, I'll write his name and remember it. But, you know, she was in the system. She knows the system.
She is in the system.
Yes.
If I'm not going to go hard for a fellow doctor, where are we? Like, if they don't go hard for one of us, then who's going to get the care that they deserve? So there was a study out of California that said, even when you correct for age, IVF, race, socioeconomic status. That was the big one. Socioeconomic status, to your point of, oh, this is because she was poor or whatever. Women of color still have poor outcomes. So I am Beyonce. I am Serena, yeah. And still not going to do as well as a white woman on welfare. Yes.
I mean, she was walking around with a PE, Serena Williams, right? Like, she was like, someone, hello, I know something's wrong. Like, listen to
me. Every time I hear that story, I just... Yeah. I'm like fuming. So with all of her quote unquote access happened
absolutely.
To her.
It's ridiculous. I remember my first pregnancy. I was in my own hospital. I'm an OBGYN and I had all these epidural complications. And my brother, who's a urologist, was like, and he was like, what's wrong? And I was telling him and they rounded on me all that. He goes, Did they do anything about it? And then he was like, no. And he actually paged the anesthesiologist on call and was like, hey, my sister, who works for your hospital, who's an OBGYN, has told you what her complications are. No one's addressing them. Someone needs to come mm-hmm. address them. I am right here watching.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for you.
It took my big brother, who's a urologist surgeon, to get the call.
Yeah.
It is my own fucking hospital. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Whatever. We love your brother for being the big brother and standing up to you. But the fact that it takes the man to call as opposed to the female patient who is sitting there. I mean, that's bias.
100%. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Well, so, I'm glad that we are hoping this gives listeners something to think about. If this is the first time that you've heard about this, if this is the 100th time you've heard about this, every day you should be thinking about the person in front of you and listening to their story and understanding, why it took them that time to get there, what the system has done to them, and try to help them through this. Our good friend Janine is, she always gives the best sort of talks. Oh. I had her on my podcast. It was wonderful. People loved it. I think it really asking the question, not only what are you here for, but what has happened to you? What has happened to you that brought you here at this point? Because something has, at the end of it.
Something has. Whatever it is did not happen overnight. Mm-hmm. And it was years of, avoiding the conversation. It was years of being dismissed and gaslighted. It was years of not having access, having quality access. It's something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the hysterectomy itself. We know historically... Mm-hmm. It was this, hysteria of women that were emotional, they're getting their wombs removed or hysterectomy. We also know that it was a tool of keeping, women oppressed. But, it can be a very profoundly healing tool, too, once you are able to accept it and understand that this might be the best way for you. So how do you counsel your patients that you think in your head, have kind of been through everything else, but scared of a hysterectomy, but they probably will feel like it's, the best thing for
time. It's time. Yeah. So I start with counseling patients about what all of their options. And like I mentioned before, the option to do nothing, the option for a sledgehammer. There's a lot of things in between. So we talk about behavioral things. We talk about the context of their life and working out and diet and supplementation. We talk about all the hormonal things. And I feel like I wish hormones, particularly the pill, we need rebranding they need a new PR because there's such a negative connotation about you give me hormones and I don't want hormones in my body. Your body is hormones. What are we talking about? So I go through all the hormonal things it's so interesting too. When I am talking about patients, what their options are, they will often okay, let's do that. I'm okay. Well, another word for that is the pill. And then can't even believe when I just present it to them in a different way that they literally chose a birth control pill. But I go through all of those sort of medical options. And then I go through the things that are less invasive. Mm-hmm. And we're talking, uterine fibroid embolization. We're talking hysteroscopy. We're talking even IUDs, which are, still a procedure. And then we go in baby steps then to hysterectomy, really helping them understand, because most women think you're just going to like take everything out. And that terrifies them. One, because so few of us, especially nowadays, sexual health and like health has been taken out of high school for so long that people have no idea what does what. And they feel, for even a lack of information about it or culturally, that they're just being robbed of their femininity.
Yeah.
Right? So I start sort of in that progression. And also in this, I tell people, you know, when you're ready to move on, you let me know. And when women come in and say, you know what, doc, I'm done. I want a hysterectomy. I go through boom, 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 boom. Okay, boo, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. And I help them understand the difference between your ovaries and why you might need them, your fallopian tubes and why you might need them, the top part of your uterus, the bottom part of it. Like really anything we do in medicine, no matter how complicated it is, I firmly believe, and not that patients aren't smart, but you can explain anything in sixth grade terms. There is no reason that we so often talk above people's heads. It belittles them. It minimizes their role in the conversation. It's intimidating. Okay. So we're using super easy terms, casual conversation. And then I ultimately let them make the decision. And then we start talking about the pros and cons of each. And listen, this doesn't happen in one visit, right? I take insurance. This is not one visit.
Absolutely.
Can't do it. And so I give them something to chew on, and then we just schedule another visit. And after they go home, they do that homework, and then they come back, we're having a conversation where she and I are on the same level talking about the same things. And then we talk about, you know, the impact of, what is she going to feel like with sex? Or like, is this going to impact her emotionally or psychologically? Or, you know, is she going to be the happiest thing since, you know, sliced bread? Like whatever it is, we cover, you know, the physical aspect, the psychological aspect, the cultural, the emotional. Because for many women, it's a goodbye. It's a goodbye. And even though they're glad it's a goodbye, it's still a goodbye.
It's hard to, like, I think we all think we would embrace the end of our menstruation, we'd embrace it, but you know, it's for some people, I mean, it's like, hey, that sign I'm getting older, this is a sign that my femininity is over, is this a sign that so you have to go through all the feels. Actually,
you have to go through all the feels. And like, it's interesting to me because, listen, my uterus turns against me, she's out. But people are not as like sledgehammers as I am, you know? And how you were raised in terms of how people see you, your ability to reproduce or not reproduce, or it's important for some people. And you have to respect that and let them work through the feels.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, you're talking about hysterectomies that are planned, but we've also been involved with unplanned hysterectomies, right? And so that creates this whole other level of trauma, because that you go in for a delivery and then, you know, I mean, that it's just as traumatic for us.
It is totally traumatic. Yeah. I have this woman that I'm working with right now, and she came in for a scheduled like twin delivery. And I just happened to be on the floor that day, and I saw people like running back and forth to the OR. I'm like, let me go back here. And, you know, because whenever you're on the floor, you're like, we don't need no mess. Let's help out. And I go back there, and her uterus looked like a pancake. She was hemorrhaging. And we were going through all the things and the medicines and the balloon, things. And I remember her doctor looking up, and by that time there were probably like four GYNs in the room. Blood is hanging, and we were like,
this is,
you know, what are we doing? And ultimately her doctor was like, you know, so-and-so, this is getting dangerous. I need to remove your uterus to save your life. And in my head, I was like, you know, she has two kids.
Yeah.
you know, it's not, you know, she'll be okay. I'm thinking she has two kids. And literally, it was like a year later, someone walks in and she's like, I want to talk to you about my hysterectomy. Uh-huh. And I was like, I actually don't know what you're talking about, because she wasn't one of my patients. And come to find out, because I was running back and forth, bringing blood, talking to her husband, she located me and was like, I just need to understand what happened and what, like, I can't get past it. And I naively was like, in my head, didn't say this, but I was like, wait, this was the twins. Yeah. And she's like, you know, I know it's silly, but I'll never be able to have, she had girls, I'll never be able to have a boy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yeah. And listen, I take for granted, I have two kids and a boy. And it's a different kind of thing. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is haunting her. And it was like a 45-minute visit. She ended up waiting until like I finished the other office hours, and we continued to talk to help her process like what was going on. And I saw her one additional time after that because she was having some sexual dysfunction. And the unplanned hysterectomy is sometimes the most traumatic, right?
Well, obstetric trauma is real, right? Like, I think there's so much obstetric trauma that we can't plan for it.
You can't plan for it. And you don't go in saying, hey, there's a chance that, you know, I consent people for hysterectomy all the time with C-sections because you just never know what's going to happen. And, you know, my residents are like, you know, you really scare people when you do that. And I'm like, this is consent. Yes.
It's a full consent.
This is what full consent is. And sometimes it's not nice or pleasant, but it is our duty to really let people know what the risk, benefits, and alternatives are for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I think as OBs, we never want to be in the situation where we have to do those, but those are usually life-saving measures. Like you talk about maternal mortality exists because, you know, we don't get to that in time, or we don't, you know.
Right. So, right. Hemorrhage is our number one reason for women dying. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh, she's alive to raise these girls. And she's grateful for that. I don't want to act like she's not grateful for that. But the trauma that comes with that is very different than someone who, for example, has uterine cancer. I understand that. I have cancer. It has to go. It's a very different experience. And both hysterectomies are indicated.
Both. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and so it really comes down to, and then you have a whole chapter on sort of consent. And I think that's where, you know, we could probably work better on with some people when they don't have the time to really sit and talk to patients. And it's the empowered consent, really. It's really a discussion. It's not just sign this risk of bleeding, risk of, you know, hemorrhage, risk of, you know, damage to a bladder, ureter, bowel. Like people don't understand that until it happens to them. And then they're like, you never told me that.
You did tell me. Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you signed a form that said it, you know, and that's what I remember that experience in residency where you would just have, the residents go in and sign the consent.
Yeah.
And so you don't know what was discussed sometimes when you're just assisting on the surgery. Like, you don't know, like, what kind of discussion had. And so I did find that, like, you know, that consent process has to be more than just sign this paper.
Exactly. And it starts, at least to me, it starts in the office. Because there shouldn't be anything that the resident says when she's being consented that should scare you, because we've already worked through all the blood and HIV risk and hepatitis risk, and we've worked through the bladder and the catheter, and we work through, you know, bowel injury. I bring someone in, and you know, we've worked through everything. So by the time you're there, you're like, okay, no, she said that. No, we talked about that already, you know? Yeah. It's super important.
Yeah, exactly. Because complications happen. And they always say, you know, as a surgeon, if you don't have complications, you're either lying or you haven't done enough surgery.
You're not doing enough.
Yes. Is that the saying? I don't know. Yeah. But anyway, but I love how you talk about that in the book as well. So I think it's very important for those of you listening that are patients to understand that you need to know all the ups and downs.
Absolutely.
And the final thing I want to talk about is we alluded to it a little bit, is like sexual function after hysterectomy, because you and I are both in the sex med space. And so I see a lot of those patients who come in, maybe didn't even realize they were having cervical orgasms, and they did not have a super cervical hysterectomy. They had a, you know, total abdominal laparoscopic or robotic hysterectomy. That means the uterus with the cervix was removed. And listen, you know, if you think about the studies out there, of course, like overwhelmingly, it's not like it says, you know, the studies are not showing better sexual function with a cervix in place. Right. But if you know, or you think that you have what is considered a vaginal orgasm, most people aren't like sure if it's cervical until their cervix is damaged, don't you think? Someone's had a leak or someone's had a hysterectomy, they didn't realize almost that their cervix was so important in their orgasm.
So important. I remember the first time I saw it. I was maybe like a year or two out of residency, and this woman came in. She had had a hysterectomy, and she's like, "I can't." She was like, "I can't come anymore," and I was like, "I don't understand that," you know, because it drives me crazy, and I do it myself. But it drives me crazy when we're like, the literature says, "Yeah, but this is her story."
This is her. Yeah.
This is her story. Mm-hmm. And so we started talking about it, and you're right. She had a total hysterectomy. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, it is a real thing. And so in consenting, one thing I always do is I always send people for second opinions. You must see this other person or some other people so that you are getting a different opinion. But one thing I talk to them about is sexual function. And I find often that when they come back, they're like, no, the doctor says I'll be fine. And I'm like, okay, but I'm letting you know. You need to know how your body responds to pleasure. And how are you going to feel if that's interrupted? Yeah. And, you know, we often sell it like, oh, but you're not going to have pap smears for the rest of your life. You don't have to worry about that. Nothing's ever going to fall. Yeah. Or yeah, but if you don't have an orgasm again.
Yeah, it's a big deal to so many people.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And I always get into it with the laparoscopic surgeons all the time. You know, there's a lot of dissection that goes there. And, you know, the pelvic anatomy and all of those nerves don't just go to one place. So I think we have to acknowledge it and have an uncomfortable conversation about, okay, so how do you orgasm?
Absolutely. It's so interesting because, the studies on it really came from people with spinal cord injuries, right? Because the cervical orgasm pathway isn't the same as, you know, a typical orgasm pathway. And so it bypasses the spinal itself and goes straight to the brain. So I think through the vagus nerve. And it's so interesting because that's how we learned that these patients that had spinal cord injuries could still orgasm because their cervix was still present.
And that's, you know, overwhelmingly not how many people orgasm. Most people orgasm.
Clitoral stimulation usually, yeah.
Yeah. So we have to do better with counseling. Because it's devastating. And over the years, I've seen it more and more that it just is ingrained in my counseling because the people who come back, it is devastating. And I can't do much. Like, we really have to help them relearn
a different way to work.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think for those of you listening that do hysterectomies or LEAPS, or even, I guess, really rigorous colposcopies with biopsies, like, always ask your patient. I do this for LEAPS too. Like, I ask my patients how they orgasm. And like, do you think that you have orgasm through vaginal penetration or clitoral stimulation? And the ones that orgasm through vaginal penetration, I tell them that you might have cervical orgasms. And if I take some of your cervix, it could impact that. And I want you to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. Because we see that post-leap too, right? We see patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't do hunk and leaps anymore, but we used to.
Oh my gosh. Some of the reports, we do hunk and leaps. And I think, you know, as gynecologists and as women and as sexual medicine people, we really understand the judicious, you know, process of thinking about the leap and not, obviously we want to detect any abnormal cells, et cetera, et cetera, but really the implications, because they're often 20, 30-year-old something women, and it's a big deal for them. So we keep all of those things in the back of our mind, not only with our technique, but with our counseling.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can go back and get more cervix, but I can't give you
You can always go back. And I tell people that, like, I'm going to get the smallest amount. We can always go back. It might be an inconvenience, but we're going to err on the side of caution. Exactly.
And then, so there's that sexual component about orgasms, and then libido is so incredibly complicated. And of course, it will depend if your ovaries are out or not. But most people, I think, that elect for a hysterectomy that's, you know, been traumatizing them through heavy bleeding or painful cycles, like, I think their libido genuinely improves, but there are people, right?
Yeah, it's funny because I think hysterectomies for abnormal bleeding or like fibroids, adenomyosis, whatever the child, that is one of the most like awesome recovery stories. And like, you just feel so gratified by those procedures because those women can turn into like sexual animals because they're just, they're not bleeding all the time. They don't have the pain. And it is just mind blowing how liberated they feel by making that decision. And so that's why I was trying to be really careful of not, the origin of hysterectomy is complicated and controversial. But when you arrive at that decision of your own accord with in conjunction with a good medical team, watch out.
For the empowered hysterectomy.
Yes, for the empowered. Like, watch out, because listen, they don't come out of the bedroom.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Camilla, before we wrap up, I got to ask you about your little history that you had on your reality.
Girl, I know. someone, I don't know. Oh, it was Pam. It was Pam. She recently outed me on Instagram about it. And it's so funny. I think the only reason I don't talk about it that much, one, because I was 19 and now I'm 48. But my kids are like, every now and then they're like, were you on TV? And I'm like, no. Because I was 19. I was living my best life. I was in...
You were recruited to go on Real World?
Yeah. Well, so no. The interesting story is I actually applied for Road Rules. Do you remember Road Rules where they would like travel around the country in an RV and do like these stunts and stuff like that? So I actually interviewed for Road Rules. And I went with a girlfriend. We were at Stanford. I saw this little line. Like, this was early email, right? And we went to San Francisco and did the interview process. And they were more interested in her, actually. Yeah. And I got a random call several weeks later that was like, hey, do you think we could meet up again in San Francisco? And so I went back to San Francisco and I was like, yeah, like I would love to travel. But and they were like, wah, wah, really? They're like, no. And they were like, well, we're looking to do this other experiment. I know you've heard of Real World before. Would you be interested? And I was like, So my grandfather had died the semester before. And so my grades were shitty. My grades were so bad. I was in a clinical depression. And I was just like, you know what? Just take me out of school. So I was like, yeah, I'm interested. And the rest is like history.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
What was it? No, was it like, did they tell you how to, I mean, I don't actually think I've watched a lot of it at all. But
yeah.
Like,
it's... I fell in love with the franchise because I remember, I don't know if you remember Pedro Zamora. He was openly gay HIV activist and he touched me and changed my life. But reality TV, our show, Real World, I cannot, it was so authentic. The things I see on TV today, I think they changed it to like reality scripted or there's some other name for it. But we know it was absolutely real. I mean, what do you think when you put like seven people from totally different, like some fireworks are going to happen? And no, it was completely unscripted. We just lived our lives and eventually there was a fight was going to happen. Like something was going to happen. And I roomed with Sean Duffy, who's our current transportation secretary. And girl,
that's so funny.
It's
so funny.
So many people would reach out and call and DM when he was being nominated. And I was just like, you know what? He's getting the job. There's nothing I need to say at this point. No, it was a great experience. It was life-changing, obviously. I don't rely on it now for anything, but at the time as a 19, 20-year-old, it was life-changing. It was being a part of like true reality history. I see people all the time because I still kind of look the same and you hear my voice and they're like, are you Camila? And you changed my life. And, you know, I did this because you did that. And I was so, and I was like, I got so much crap from it when I was there. People would call me like uppity black girl. It was just like, who does she think she is? You know, it was just I got such a backlash, but I was one of the first examples of a highly educated, I mean, I went to Stanford, but like Ivy League-ish black woman.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And all the other representations, and I love those women, but were so like stereotypical of what the world wanted black women to be. And I wasn't that. I was nerdy. I was hardworking. I was all the things. Yeah. And so to sit back now and have people come up to me and be like, you did that. You did. I'm like, okay, thank you.
I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Love it.
So
all good.
Yeah, I'm still hiding from my kids, though. They'll find it eventually.
They'll find it
eventually. Yeah.
I always do.
I have some explaining
to do. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, you're amazing. You're doing so many good things. I'm so proud to call you my friend.
Thank you.
I love everything you're doing. I can't wait to see all the other stuff that happens. But one last thing is my husband jokes that like my listeners are called, he calls them, they're all like a bunch of vigilantes.
So, wait, who is it? Say it again.
My husband jokes that my listeners are probably a bunch of the vigilantes. You know, they're like,
don't mess with us. Then don't mess with us.
Exactly. So I kind of have this thing called the vigilante verdict, which is your hot take. Like, what's your hot take for people to remember, listen, that you're telling us from today?
You know what I would say is like, you're magical. You know what I mean? You are magical and you're uniquely you, and you deserve information, you deserve advocacy, you are deserving of time. And to not lose that when you walk into the medical establishment, there's nothing about you that doesn't deserve full engagement in your health. And so that would be my take home is like, you drive the ship. We are there to help you decide what is best for you on your own terms. That's what I would say is, you know, you're magical and deserving.
And you deserve it. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, thank you, Camila. This has been a great conversation. Thanks. I hope somebody has learned something from today and thinks about, if you're a clinician, you're thinking about that person in front of you. If you are going through this, remember you need to get more information. You need to get Camila's book. It's great. If you're about to have a hysterectomy, you just want to learn a little bit more about some women's health issues. But thanks again for listening, everyone. I'm Dr. Smita Ron, Gyno Girl. Thanks for listening to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.